Do you like D&D, improv, and a podcast where the DM can't control the player's intrusive thoughts? Well then, Flip of Fate is what you're looking for. This loosely D&D podcast is about four misfits being roped in on an adventure by a wealthy centaur wizard. We also have a three-part Halloween special out now set in the modern world about four teens caught up in a small-town horror. We played that one shot in a simplified D&D system close to the Call of Cthulhu system. Now in our main campaign, we play in D&D 5e. And if you're looking for some nitty, gritty D&D and advanced rule following, you won't find it here. We're just five close friends that enjoy improv and D&D with some chaos mixed in there. So come and check us out. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts at Flip of Fate. You can also find us on all socials. So stop by and say hi. Again, find us and listen to us at Flip of Fate. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your show.
Hey, Danger Dangers here with a special Halloween announcement. Part 1 of our Patreon-exclusive Halloween bonus content will be premiering Wednesday, October 16th. Stick around to the end of the episode after the credits and blooper for a sneak preview of that. Remember, you can access any of our bonus content by signing up on Patreon for just $5 a month, or by volunteering as an episode transcript and wiki writer. Shoot an email to dndarkpodcast@gmail.com for more info on that. That's all for now. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, a show where I chat with other creators in the TTRPG space about how they run their tables. I'm Danger Dan Jers, the GM and host of D&D Dark, and joining us at the table today is the team from the podcast Dread and Breakfast. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
Please introduce yourselves and tell us a little about your show.
We should have picked first who was going to go first, guys. How did we not do that?
I see the nose goes.
Bob, you do it because the show is your idea.
Me?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know that that's true. Hi, my name is Fob, and apparently Dread and Breakfast was my idea, or as I like to say, my fault.
Hi, my name is Christine. I am a player and occasional DM on Dread and Breakfast. Fun fact, I had never played a TTRPG before starting this show, so I have learned
Yay!
A lot through getting to collaborate with my friends.
Hi, I'm Jacob, a participant. Also had not played any type of really RPG at all before playing this, so also learning with Christine from these other two, and it's been great.
Hi, I'm Marissa, the last member of Dread and Breakfast. I am also an occasional DM. I do the sound design, player, and like Fob, I have played many RPGs, of which Dread is a favorite. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. So I guess we can nose goes this depending on who wants to give the Dread spiel.
Oh, we plan that out.
Yes.
Oh, perfect. So I will default to your planning. But for anybody who is unfamiliar with how Dread works, since you primarily work in the Dread system, please explain what that's all about.
What up, nerds? It's me, Fob. I'm here to explain the Dread system to you, someone who has hopefully played an RPG before. Dread is a horror RPG, and normally, to resolve things in RPGs, you roll dice. In Dread, you pull a block from a wooden tower of blocks. It could be a Jenga tower. It could also be Wood Toys Fold High, a fun Chinese knockoff that I found on the internet.
It just needs to be legally distinct.
That's true. Don't let Hasbro come for you. Anyways, if the tower of blocks that you're pulling from ever falls or collapses when you pulled it, your character is removed from the game. That could be dying a gruesome, bloody death, or it could be mom called you in and you can't play outside at night with your friends anymore. So you can kind of set the tone based on that. Those are probably the two extremes. Instead of a character sheet that has numbers and stats on it, what you fill out is a questionnaire that kind of gives a basic rundown of who your character is. And it's very open in that way that basically even character creation is kind of a dialogue back and forth between like GM and player. If the GM wants to set it in a magic setting, you kind of get to hash out what is magic? How does that work? What's the scope of your powers all on the questionnaire? And you pull from the tower if you're ever doing something either like hurried or pressed, or if you're doing something that you wouldn't be able to do normally as based on the questionnaire.
Thank you for that. In going through your show, I really enjoy seeing how all that manifests.
Oh, thank you.
So one of the things that you guys do that I really like is you've explored kind of a wide range of options of what happens when the tower falls.
Yes.
To tie it more directly back to your show and your narrative, mm-hmm. you've had characters die, you've had characters get possessed, you've had characters that their fate is not necessarily sealed, but they're just kind of out of the game and you tag in a new character.
Mm-hmm.
In one or two of your games, because you've had a character marked for death, but not immediately removed when the tower comes down,
mm-hmm.
just as a personal question, what happens if a person knocks down the tower, stays on board, you have them keep pulling and they knock down the tower a second time?
It depends.
Yeah, we did run into that, I think, not where somebody re-knocked the tower down, but in season one, we did have some characters who were doomed and then their players continued pulling. And we actually, I think it might have been when we did our in-between episodes with our friend Alicia,
yeah.
where she asked that same question about, well, what happens here if it knocks over again?
You double die.
Double death.
But for season two, like, we kind of regrouped and figured out, like, what is our rule? So now, and I think that this is also reflective of what's in the Dread book, if a character is doomed, that their actions just are also doomed if they don't die immediately. So they wouldn't be pulling because they would just automatically fail.
Gotcha.
You're much more constrained at that point to the character sheet. It's like, I can successfully do whatever I had the wherewithal to write on the character sheet. Somehow everyone always writes that they have a knife on the character sheet.
Some of us are just really good at finding knives.
That's true.
Yeah, you can get the resource, get the resource.
And the character sheets are really powerful, both for DM and player, like Fab said, mm-hmm. for setting tone and also for setting inventory lists. Like in the Dread book, which is written by Epidiah Ravikal, along the bottom of every page are just sample questions, and they range vastly in terms of tone and setting. And one of the recurring like ideas is like, okay, what do you have in your back pocket? What's in your bedroom? What do you always have with you? So it helps to give the player something to work with of, oh, well, I always keep my grandfather's knife up my sleeve.
That does highlight a thing about the system and about your show that I do really like that I want to discuss a little bit is how collaborative everything is. Mm. It's much more narratively driven than more mechanically based TTRPGs like D&D or Pathfinder. So a thing that your show does that I respect immensely and that I really want to pick your guys' brains about is the way that you structure your seasons.
Oh.
I know for season one, you kind of stumbled into it as a happy accident, but for season two, it seems like it's more the focus going out front. But the way that your show has run so far is that your seasons tend to focus on a central theme or setting, and you have a rotating cast of GMs all playing around that same narrative and building off of each other. I want to ask about how the process of planning and implementing that goes, what it's like having multiple rotating GMs, how you run that structure, what stays secret, what gets more universally known. So like for season one, everything was centered around the secret organization ORCS. And for season two, it appears that everything is centered around the central location of the town of Spillman. Give as many or as few plot specifics that you want to spoil, but how do you go about structuring something like that? And what does that look like when you're implementing it?
Happy accident was kind for season one. That was just me biting off more than I could chew and Marissa fixing it for me.
That's not true.
In post.
It's pretty true.
It's pretty true.
I brought some birds to the table.
No, you did. Yes, bring a lot of birds to the table, of which we are grateful.
Season one's, I think, pretty easy to explain, and anyone tell me if I'm wrong about this. Season one, I had the idea, oh, I want the bad organization to be called orcs. Let's go from there. What can that stand for? And I worked backwards. I don't know if that's what you're supposed to do, but I did, and it seemed to work. So we're going to run with it. Season two has been much more collaborative from like the ground up.
Mm.
For season one, there was no like, everyone knows what orcs are. No, It was just a thing in my head. And then Christine, I think before you ran yours, it was like, is this kind of the vibe? And I was like, yeah, that's kind of the vibe. And then we ran with it. And then Marissa, you were like, is this the vibe? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then you were like, well, could they do this? And I was like, and in my head, I'm like, I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, yeah, of course they can do that. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, season one was a lot of accidental, oh yeah, and then this happens. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which I think a lot of that was us finding our like table as well.
Yes.
Because Bob and I had played RPGs together. We met playing D&D, but we had never played an RPG like all together that was not either like a test episode for the show or the show itself. And I personally hadn't really DM'd much until the show. So, oh God, can you hear someone's really loud motorcycle outside? Motherfucker.
I'll be right back.
Bob's going to shoot him.
He has the knife. He has the shiv. But I think if memory serves, so ORCS, I guess if you're still listening to season one, stop, fast forward the next like 30 seconds, stands for the Oddity Research and Containment Specialists. Anyone who was not Fabrice did not know that until I think the second to last story of the season. So even among DMs, we had no idea. We were writing stories for a narrative we did not know. We had been given the title of the movie, but not the script, and said, go act. So it was definitely very challenging learning experience that was very fun to retroactively piece it together. I think we much prefer to do it how we've done it for season two, which involves a lot more prep work.
And a lot more sticky notes.
Yeah.
So many sticky notes.
We had a big, huge brainstorming session when we knew that we wanted to embark on a second season, where we just went through rounds of writing down every idea that we could think of about what might be an interesting theme to bring to a season. Something that we wished that we had in season one that we want to set up a structure for coming into season two. What's a piece of sound design that we want to explore? What's something with how we promote the show that we want to explore? Literally all of the spaghetti onto the wall. And from there, we then just basic brainstorming practice. You start to physically group these sticky notes together. And soon we had a place that was forming that we were all very interested in. Soon we had a villain that was forming, an idea of storytelling and lore and folklore. We had some vague ideas of how we wanted things to sound. And so from there, I think we actually used some prompts from the Quiet Year game to continue to build the setting of the town of Spillman. And so we understood together, where are we? We knew we wanted to move through time in this same place and really dig in deep. And we understood, you know, what's the very, very old lore? And then where are we now when we pick up the season? And then from there, what sort of time periods are we interested in telling stories about? And that's where, you know, the DM preference and the DM specific prep can come in. And so that's where all the secrets can kind of be held from each other.
And enough of a like threading together, because I know in our earliest production meetings, it was like, okay, well, Fab wants to run a story in the 20s that maybe has to do with the cemetery. And like Christine wanted to run one in the 50s about a diner. So I had the absolute delight to run the first story in season one. So it's like, okay, well, let me just mention a diner and let me just mention a cemetery so that ideally we can go back and kind of weave things in more coherently from the beginning. And also like zooming out outside of like our show a little bit and in terms of like the structure of it, we kind of picked a really hard way to structure seasons because it's wildly different for each of our different DM styles. And it's also vignettes where we inhabit the characters and the setting so briefly. Like Dread is designed to be able to be played in a night. So we're in these spaces for such a short amount of time. And you can play Dread over a long campaign, but Dread is really deadly, like, because it's Jenga. Most people are not good at Jenga, so your characters die very frequently, and you really just have to get, you know, all right, what's my new character? How do we bring them in? Which can be really challenging for a show. So that's where I think the little vignettes are both challenging in terms of character development in, you know, 3 hours over the course of like 3 or 4 episodes, but also very freeing in, let me really go hard because I might not make it through this story.
I do usually wish that I got more time to spend with each character.
Yeah.
Which is why it's helpful that we have our breakfast episodes, because then sometimes if you don't get to play through an aspect that maybe you thought about in the backstory or there's lingering questions, we can answer them for each other. And then off mic, we also do what we refer to as bridge meetings, where basically after every story, we circle the wagons, we make sure we're all on the same page about what happened in the story, what questions do we have, what questions might the audience still have, because sometimes we know things the audience doesn't, so we got to play along that line. And then what are the big questions that we want the next story or two in the season to answer. So I think at this point, we generally have an idea of what our season-long arc will be, and we know what our stories are going to be. But, I mean, the others can jump in here. I have no idea how it's going to wrap up and resolve. I know what year we're going to end in, but I don't know what's going to happen or even who's going to be there at this point.
Yeah. So. And it's like the storyteller in me finds that collaborative piece of it and that improv piece of it so freeing, because I know like the next Dread that for season 2 that I'm going to run, I know the year, I know a couple of beats that I want to hit. But based on what Christine and Fab have done in their respective vignettes that precede that, everything is wildly different than I thought it would. And there's just so much more to evolve and to draw on. And also, like, I know where we're going to end. I don't know how we do it or where we get there. And it's really interesting to be writing a story together that you don't know even the next like sentence for, let alone the ending for. So I don't know. It's a lot of fun.
I find that that is the beauty of actual plays and of TTRPGs as a whole, is they share a lot in common with long form improv.
Absolutely.
And I love that you guys do those bridge meetings. That is such a good idea. And a thing that I've come to notice a little bit, the term retcon in any other context outside of actual plays and TTRPGs is a lot more loaded and weighted and negative. Mm-hmm. But like by its actual definition, it is retroactive continuity. And I find that some of the best moments in actual play podcasts are positive retcons. I find that that happens a lot more frequently in long form improv stories. Since you are working together to kind of discover the story as it's happening, it's very often some of the biggest impact moments are what recontextualize earlier moments.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
A lot of the joy of season 1 was seeing in those later stories how earlier stories would get recontextualized as new information was being established that would put earlier plot points in a different light. So on a similar train of thought, but slightly tangential, with each of those more disparate and disconnected stories in season 1, do any of you have a particular favorite story that you think really shines and shows off? I know it's tricky with season 2 since it's still so early on in its production, and since you have one full campaign and one partial campaign at the time of this recording.
I have a favorite one that I have played in for season 1. And then I don't know that I'll weigh in on season 2 yet because it's just not, it's not done yet. But I really enjoyed Spectrophobia in season 1 because A, I like that I got to sacrifice myself. That was cool. And then B, I wasn't expecting this, but I like that it made me come back as a very funny, maybe insensitive Australian
Carrot is a legend.
Carrot was great, and I loved playing him.
Jacob, do you want to weigh in next?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, and I'm in a different position from everyone else because I haven't run any games
yet.
But our Deep Sea one. I forget what phobia name we gave it, because the phobia naming convention was not great.
That was the hardest one for me to say personally.
Thalassophobia, I know well because I have that phobia.
Okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's my favorite, so I'm sorry.
No, I really enjoyed that one.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no, that was a really fun one. I think that was, I don't know. I don't want to say us finding our stride, because I think we had found, I mean, we find it again every story, but I mean, it was definitely kind of a milestone for us of things coming together and us working together in a lot of really good ways. That was fun. That's maybe the best I felt about a character, like as a new person, feeling like I understood my character and my motivations and what he would say, et cetera, et cetera. And it's also one we got to submit to some festivals, and I got to travel around a little bit sharing that with some people, which was really great. So
it is a really unique one. I think the tension is especially high on that one because, spoiler if you have not listened to this story, being the only one so far where none of the characters die.
Yes.
Yeah. Added an extra layer of tension to it.
That felt so special in the moment because as we were recording it, every aspect of it felt like capturing lightning in a bottle because our characters came together in a way that really felt like Jacob said, like we were hitting our stride, and our pace of how fast we were recording the episodes was also so much quicker than anything that we had done before. So the story, I think, was really, really in the forefront of everybody's mind for that entire story. So then the fact that we were so unified as a party, then that nobody died, like it was really, really intense. And I don't know if that story, if I would like it as much. I mean, it's hard to say because it didn't happen, but like, I think you're right. The fact that nobody died does kind of make it a very, very special thing. And if someone had died, I don't know if I would feel the same about it.
And I was going hard on you guys too at the end.
Well,
you have to do these things, so you need pulls. And it just worked out. It was really cool. Yeah, I would agree with you, Jacob. That one was also really special.
And I think that one for me also captured, on like a very personal note, the balance between this feels simultaneously that we are making a show and we are performing and we are doing all these, you know, like highfalutin things, but also really captured like, yeah, I'm playing an RPG with my friends and this is wild. And yes, Christine, please text your landlord because we are all screaming and it is fully 11 p.m. Because like the session ran late. We didn't want to end. Like it was just really, really lovely.
As a base of comparison, I sympathize with a lot of what you've said in regards to that specific one. That is very similar to the conditions we were recording Call of Cthubidu in. That was 2 days back to back.
Wow.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's the dream.
It was the tightest we've ever done a story. And I think that's a big part of why it came together as well as it did.
Yeah.
Was because everything was condensed into a very short period. It was at the forefront of everybody's mind. And you can clearly tell the amount of love that everybody has for the source material.
Yes.
It was a really fun celebration of everything. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done prep-wise.
Really? Why? Why?
It's an interesting thing system-wise. Like, compared to D&D, Call of Cthulhu is actually an easier system to run.
It's weird how D&D is actually hard to, like, 5th edition is not easy and is not intuitive. It's crazy to me. We've all tricked ourselves. It's not, everyone's like, oh, it's 5e. You can do that. And it's just because all of us have been doing it for years. But it's like, it's super not intuitive. It's crazy.
There are absolutely easier systems, and Call of Cthulhu is a trade-off because it is an easier system to run. It is way harder to prep.
Is it because it's a mystery?
Yes. Typically, it is centered around gathering information and unraveling world building. So you really have to have a tight control on the pace of information.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's hard.
Call of Cthubidu was a particularly tricky one because I set myself up to have to run essentially two separate mysteries simultaneously that weaved in and out of each other. Controlling that pace of information and setting everything up for that was one of the hardest things I've done in the entire show. And I was thinking before we sat down to record it, I don't know why I did this to myself. I'm never doing this again. This is terrible. This was so much work. And then when we were like 5 minutes into the session, immediately, this was all worth it. This was
yes.
That's so good.
I'm so glad that you got that too. That's awesome.
It so clearly shines through, like, as you as a DM and also you as like a table, because like there was such a sense of like trusting each other, them trusting you to like give them the information that they need, you trusting them to like have some shenanigans, as we do, of course, but still like find their way back to the rails and really pick up, okay, this is important. And just like the synergy was like you were all mind melding. It was such a joy. It was so good.
Everyone really was on their A game for that. But anyway, to circle back around to all of you, with those more bite-sized short-form stories, regardless of like personal preference or favorability, is there anyone that you think best demonstrates your show? And like, which one would you point to people to say, start here? Because I know for me, Call of Cthubidu is what I point to tell people, hey, start here, because it's easier to absorb a 4-episode mini campaign than it is a 60-episode multi-year event.
That's fair.
I think that I would actually point people towards the beginning of season 2. Our seasons stand alone. You don't have to listen to one to understand the other. But I feel like season one was a lot of learning about how we wanted to produce the show. And so season 2, we kind of came out guns a-blazin', so to speak, from a production standpoint. And it's the beginning of the story. The finale of season 1 is also at a similar level with production, but it's hard to tell people to start with the finale of a story. I'd probably point people to Witch in the Woods, the beginning of season 2.
That was going to be what I said too. So,
synergy.
Marissa, do you also agree? Tell us now.
I think objectively, either that or the Camp Needlewood in between episode, just because it's a standalone thing. It was the first time all of us were players, which were fun.
That was very fun.
Having run Witch in the Woods, I have a very different feel for what could have been and how I would DM it differently. And that's a lot of just personal bias coming through. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think in terms of production, especially with like sound design and world building and just collaborative storytelling, season 2 is something really special already. And I'm excited to see how it continues to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And how many other crow trains people spawn into existence.
Oh, I don't know if we've published anything with crow train.
Oh, we
yet.
Haven't. Oh, no.
That's a teaser.
Oh, no.
Speaking about what is in the pipeline and coming down the road, I want to talk about just kind of where you guys see different avenues that you will explore later down the line coming into play. A lot of your stories tend to be more paranormal centric. You do a lot of stuff that focuses on ghost stories. You've delved into cryptids a little bit. Are there any other subgenres of horror that you're looking to explore later down the line? Are you going to have more monster centric stories? Are you going to have more like slasher stories? Anything like that?
Oh, that's such a good question.
We haven't said anything in stone for anything. So it's hard to say. We're still pretty early in season 2. I'll say sci-fi, I think, is something that's come up a couple times. And we've all said, oh, that seems interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
We all want to go to space.
Yeah. Space freaks me the fuck out. Let's go to space. Yeah. Like,
and I have something in the works that would lean that direction. So I don't know. It might be. I might try to angle that as a backdoor pilot whenever that happens.
A season 3 Jacob special, perhaps?
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see if it ever happens.
Yeah, I would love to explore sci-fi. The slasher thing's interesting because we also have above table a series of like safety tools, and like because we're dealing with horror, slasher in particular, I don't know if like that would be right for our table, just because I'm a little baby and some like body horror stuff freaks me out deeply. But I would love to see different avenues that we can explore and like see where the boundaries are and how we can push and pull each other in a safe and like good way. That is fun to listen to. I love a good monster flick. Like I adore all of D&D Dark so much. I would love to like see if there's some sort of angle we could do on that. The funnest part about the show is that all of us are at a point where if any of us brought a bonkers idea, I think the response would be like, okay, Let's see what happens. Let's make it work.
I think you guys touched on this in one of your breakfast segments, but we were in kind of a similar boat. We got several episodes in before we realized, oh, yeah, safety tools. We should probably do something like that.
Yeah.
Oops.
Oh, it's a horror podcast. We should be safe about that. That's a scary space.
Fortunately, the way we tread into that was that I accidentally kind of triggered myself.
Yeah.
Rather than anybody, you know, causing harm to another person. So I think we got lucky. But yeah, if you're going to, honestly, it doesn't even need to be a horror game. If you're going to start a game, like, bring in your safety tools. That's an important part because it just helps build better trust amongst your table, which even if you're not making a show, is very, very important to have.
Yes.
When you're adventuring and telling a story together.
Absolutely. The more explicit you can make your boundaries, the better you can foster community and trust.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have more freedom as a player as well to know, yeah, I can really wild out and go crazy on this because everybody's cool with it.
Yes.
Or if for some reason something comes up that someone suddenly isn't, we all have an out and we have an understood way of communicating that.
And I feel like it also, it helps you as a GM because it's like, oh, okay, I can go hard here because I'm not crossing this line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm maybe even like, I'm not even going close to this line because my friends don't want me to. And I don't want to upset my friend. Like, I don't want to make my friends uncomfortable. That's a dick move.
Yeah. We're looking for delicious horror.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that is mostly the end of my list of questions. Do you have any other miscellaneous things that you all would like to add, either about your show, about D and Dark, about tabletop stuff in general?
Oh.
I just forgot every word in the English language. That question.
What has been your most rewarding part of making D and Dark?
That is a good question. Either big narrative moments that have huge payoffs that have been long in the works,
mm-hmm.
or when the characters get to pull off a huge success or a minor mm-hmm. success and just hearing the joy in their voices and the fun that they're having.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a few moments I can point to in particular. I would say something that is less spoilery because it happens relatively early on. At the tail end of the museum arc.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That was for Daniel, who plays Imhotep. That was like a major milestone and stepping stone for him as an actor. And he told me afterwards, Daniel and I went to high school together and we both did theater. And a thing that he always struggled with that our theater teacher was trying to get through to him was he always took kind of an outside in approach and always struggled internalizing characters. Where he would put on characters like a costume, he wouldn't really live in them. And that was a turning point for him where he had his light bulb moment during that arc of, I get it now.
Wow.
Oh, that's so cool.
Wow. And that, like, as a listener, was such a kick-ass fucking moment. And at that time, when I listened to it, I had not seen the 1999 hit classic, The Mummy. So I was... only had like Daniel and like his portrayal of Imhotep and I can't remember her name, but she was lovely. Aungsuna Moon's like portrayal from this podcast. And even I was getting weepy. Like they absolutely crushed it. Like you all crushed it. So that's give him like a confetti popper from me. Like way to go. It was awesome.
Absolutely. That is part of why I have put him specifically through so much in the show is because he proved that I could.
And he's carrying that too. It's I love the what does somebody call them? The Imhotep episodes?
Yes. Which that's a whole thing. It was like 10% planned.
But sometimes it's the things that you stumble into that end up becoming the most like narratively fulfilling or just
oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah. The payoff to the Imhotep episodes is one of the things that I am most viscerally satisfied by. So, like you said, we just kind of stumbled into that plot arc and we a few steps in, I started kind of laying down the pipeline to that, and it was the thing that we were really kind of fleshing out in progress as it was happening. And I think it's one of the highlights and one of the hardest hitting resolutions to a thing that we've had.
Nice.
Ooh, delicious. I'll make some popcorn then.
I have a question. So I have only DM'd twice and both of them have been for the show. So I feel like I'm getting a better grasp of what my personal DM style is and how I prep for it. I find that I'm pulling a lot of influence from my work with novel writing, but that's not always beneficial for DMing. So I like to ask any seasoned DM, what is like one piece of advice that either somebody gave to you or a light bulb moment or some sort of technique that you use, some kind of guiding principle? Like what's a big cornerstone of how you DM and or something that you've learned as you've DM'd over the years?
That is a very good question. A lot of what I pull from when I'm DMing is my background in doing improv.
Mm-hmm.
I did short form improv all throughout high school and a little bit into college. I was doing improv with comedy sports.
Ah.
And there's a lot of things that I've learned from doing improv and from general theater stuff that apply really well to DMing and to TTRPGs. Because essentially, you are with a TTRPG, you are doing a long form improv with very heavy guardrails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So communication and transparency are huge.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that you can collaborate with your players, the better the outcome is going to be. So mm-hmm. I've a thing that I've tried to do and shift over towards more with time is giving each of them more opportunities to narrate or describe things, to get their perspectives in on it, and to give them a heavier hand on the wheel. So as a base of comparison, kind of a teaser for what's to come.
Yes, ooh, yes.
I would say we are about 75% of the way through our first season. Once we finish that up and do our second season from the ground up, it is a lot more collaborative.
Ooh.
So the way that season one actually started was I was with a completely different table. I wanted to do a Halloween one shot.
Nice.
So I basically put together what turned into the first five episodes of this show. And in doing that, I realized there's not a one shot. So because it was going to be a just for fun Halloween one shot, everybody coming in, they basically picked up these character sheets that were already completed, that they were already building off of with these more established characters that they could draw the lore from. They still, in time, spun them to make them more their own, but it was a lot of them meeting me at what I had brought.
Mm-hmm.
With season two, I dropped a tease in my previous interview. Season two is going to be cryptids.
Ooh. Oh, yes!
Nice. Very
oh my
nice.
God.
It'll be set in America. And it'll be Bigfoot, Mothman, the Jersey Devil, the Loch Ness Monster,
yes!
and the Roswell Alien.
Oh, yes! Oh my God.
That's
yes!
so cool.
Holy shit. Give me the merch now.
Because these are more folkloric characters that have a lot less predefined stories to pull from, there's a lot more room for interpretation. So they brought a lot of ideas that have lent themselves to the world building at large. And the more that I've integrated their ideas, the more excited I get about the story, the more interesting and fleshed out it gets, because yeah. their brains go places that mine never would. So I guess to circle back around to the advice, being communicative with your players, figuring out what their ideas are and what it is they want, and to make it something a bit more practical, if a player has an idea that you cannot let fly mechanically, I try to figure out, what is it that you want from this? What is your goal here?
Yeah.
Because I can try to meet you halfway. Their methods I won't let fly, but I want to still help them get where they want to go.
And I really admire that, and I really enjoy that about D&D Dark. Like, that was one of the things when I was listening to the show that I picked up on and was like really appreciative of, because I'm pretty familiar with fifth edition. I'm getting a little tired of it, but like it's loosely based on fifth edition, and it's like, nice, that's cool. And then where you let the kind of like bend the rules a little bit of fifth edition is really cool and always interesting, and I always appreciate that of a DM, where it's like, if I have a cool idea, like, I'm not trying to rule of cool something, but like, I feel like this should maybe be possible. Can we work a way to make this kind of a thing happen? And it's really cool that I can see that you're doing that for players. That's really fun.
It's definitely a thing that I've been working on and trying to actively make a bigger effort at.
Well, even from jump, I saw it. So,
well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I have a question. Do you have a favorite system to DM for? Mm. And do you have a favorite system to play in?
That is an excellent question. I've played three systems. I've done D&D 5e, I've done Pathfinder 2nd edition, and Call of Cthulhu 7th edition.
Nice.
All fun.
I would say the most fun that I've had was with Call of Cthulhu, but with the big caveat that it is a lot harder to write for.
Right.
I've heard generally, if you take the pre-written modules for Call of Cthulhu, it is very simple and easy to run, because one of the things about it is you never have to determine any sort of mechanics for skill checks, because that is all baked into the character sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thresholds for success and failure are directly attached to every single stat. So all you have to determine is whether somebody is attempting something that is of normal difficulty, hard difficulty, or extreme difficulty, and whether they've got any bonuses or penalties going into that. And that's it. You don't have to come up with any numbers or anything like that, because it's already on the character sheet.
Yeah.
So that makes mm-hmm. running it a lot easier and a lot smoother. And it's fun to play around in that theming. There's a lot more freedom for narrative. It is also similarly an incredibly deadly system. So
yeah.
It does lend itself to much shorter form games and campaigns, unless you've got a stack of characters that you're willing to burn through.
Yeah.
Yep.
Most of my experiences with D&D, I've played a little bit of Pathfinder. I've DM'd a little bit of Pathfinder. They each kind of have their own pros and cons. Pathfinder is a bit more complex than D&D mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
D&D is more of an individual power fantasy.
Yeah.
Pathfinder is more of a collective team of heroics. And the difficulty also scales higher. Everything,
yeah.
Everything hits harder and is more resilient from the jump in Pathfinder. I would say my favorite thing to run is kind of an amalgamation of systems. On D&D Dark, you'll see there's a lot of things that I steal directly from other systems.
That's the best form of flattery.
Yeah.
So like the whole system for how we do Devil's Bargains is stolen.
Yes.
It's stolen vaguely from the Star Wars TTRPG system. They basically their version of inspiration is they have force tokens.
Oh.
Which there are three force points that start off as light side force points that the players can use. They can take one and burn it for advantage. And when they burn one, the DM gets a dark side point.
Oh.
And it's kind of a tug of war. Every time one side uses a resource, the other side gets another one.
That's cool.
I like that.
That's really cool.
So Devil's Bargains are extrapolated from that, fit more directly into kind of our purposes. We make it way more busted than it should be.
Oh, yeah.
But it leads for good, interesting narrative moments.
Oh, absolutely. And as soon as we met the devil, like suddenly, oh, haha, what a fun mechanic. Oh, no, there are narrative consequences also, which was delicious to listen to. So
all right. Any other last miscellaneous things?
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is
so exciting.
Please remind us as we are wrapping up one more time where we can find your show.
We have a website, dndbpod.com. On Instagram, we are dndbpod. On Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, we're dreadandbfast. You can also drop us a line directly to our email, dreadandbreakfastpod@gmail.com. Is that right?
That's it.
Yes.
Okay. I had to double check that today.
They're all different, and that's terrible for me because I'm in charge of keeping up with them all.
Thank you, Christine.
Also, the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Listen to our show.
Absolutely give them a listen. It is a fantastic show. And thank you all again for stopping by to chat. I'm Danger Dan Jers, and I hope everyone enjoyed what we brought to the table. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Table Talk, created, hosted, and edited by myself, Danger Dan Jers, with artwork by Jordan Nelson. Our guests this episode were Fabrice, Marissa, Jacob, and Christine from Dread and Breakfast. Links to their show can be found in the episode description. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, reach out to us at dndarkpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme song and outro was created by Jeremy Vellucci. Check out more of his works on Instagram at jeremyvellucci_recoftime.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time we have a guest take a seat at the table.
Welcome to D&D Dark Presents Muppet Alien. I am your host and game mother, Daniel Cruz.
It's time to light the light.
Captain Miller, wait for me!
There's no way. It's been 75 years.
There is a way, because that's how long this ship has been missing, according to Weyland-Yutani records.
Check the radar to see what it is that Davis was looking for, and to make sure that it happens. Hi-ya!
You push the button, you hear the rumble of the elevator shaft from the elevator rising. When the door opens, you can see that there has been a firefight in here.
Do we want to take the stairs?
So as long as you didn't roll over a 6, you guys managed to keep it together. Just barely.
So hopefully we're looking for Muppet reviews.
Well, if you're gonna be making comments like that, I'm gonna have to charge you.
You charge me? We are on a mission by Weyland-Yutani. You can't charge me. I'm the one charging you.
Listen. Semantics, alright?
Alright, I've got one question for all of you here. What is happening?
D&D Dark presents Muppet Alien. Premiering October 16th, 2024, only on patreon.com/dndarkpodcast.
It's time to leave.